Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 12, Episode 2, A Question of Influence. During the tenures of Tokugawa's Ieyasu and Ieyasu, the Bakufu contended with a lot of big-picture problems for which it was ill-suited and ill-equipped to solve. The rise in frequency of agrarian riots and other large-scale public disturbances were certainly a far cry from the stability enjoyed during the reigns of previous shoguns. In the midst of the chaotic second half of the 1700s, some segments of Japanese society began to wonder whether they might be better off without the Bakufu. For many of these would-be dissidents, there was only one practical option for their replacement: the imperial court. It has been some time since we discussed the emperor and his court, but you may recall from last season that in 1627 there was a thoroughly polite dust-up called the Purple Robe Incident, in which the sitting emperor Go Mizunowo granted special purple robes to honor high-ranking members of religious orders, despite the shogunate's ban on this practice. The purple robes were rescinded after some wrangling between the court and Edo, and the priests in question sent into exile. Go Mizunowo Tenno retired 2 years later after this and other humiliations due to similar Bakufu power plays. In 1634, as though to punctuate the Bakufu's dominance over the court, Tokugawa Iemitsu arranged a large military parade to march from Edo to Kyoto with over 300,000 warriors. This would be the last time a shogun would visit Kyoto for almost 250 years. By the mid-1700s, the imperial court was still largely bereft of any real influence among the populace, and at that moment certainly presented no practical threat to the shogunate. In spite of its contemporary weakness, the Bakufu was still in a very strong position during the reigns of Ieyasu and Ieyasu. They possessed or controlled the lion's share of Japan's productive output, their surveillance infrastructure kept even the most obstinate daimyo in line, and Sankin Kotai, or alternating attendants, ensured that the daimyo were kept under close watch. After the death of Yoshimune in 1751, however, a few noteworthy people began to openly criticize the Bakufu and even state their own preference for a nation governed by the emperor instead. One such imperial champion was a physician's son named Takenouchi Shikibu. He came to Kyoto sometime in the mid-1700s and enjoyed the patronage of a kuge named Tokudaiji Kinshiro. Shikibu devoted himself to the teachings of Suika Shinto, which was a popular school of kami worship that combined indigenous religion with certain teachings of Neo-Confucianism. Takenouchi Shikibu became radicalized by his understanding of Suika Shinto and publicly proclaimed loyalty to the imperial throne first and foremost. He even went so far as to encourage the sitting emperor Momozono and his kuge to refuse orders from the Bakufu and publicly rise up against them, assuring them that the rest of the nation would eagerly rise in support. The higher-ranking kuge in Momozono Tenno's court, however, advocated strenuously against such a rebellion, and instead reported Shikibu's actions to the Bakufu representatives in Kyoto, the Shoshidai, who ordered Shikibu expelled from the city and arrested some of the kuge who had attended his lectures in 1758. When Shikibu refused to honor his expulsion, he was exiled to Hachijo, a remote island over 100 miles south of Kanto. Shortly after this, however, there was a similar incident in Edo. In 1760, an instructor at one of Edo's many martial arts schools named Yamagata Daini began incorporating his own views on the supremacy of the imperial court into his usual lectures, and even went so far as to write a book which was scathingly critical of the Bakufu. In 1767, one of Daini's students named Fuji Umon publicly proclaimed the need to use violence to overthrow the shogunate and restore the emperor. The Bakufu rushed to investigate, imprisoning Umon and executing Daini. These particular incidents were far from the only occasions in which the Bakufu doled out harsh punishments for treason. However, they are useful for illustrating just how nervous the shogunate leadership was about the potential emergence of any rival for national governance. Although he was generally well-liked, Emperor Momozono was absolutely not equipped to take charge of national affairs in any way, nor were his kuge in spite of the eagerness which some of them displayed for imperial restoration. In the years immediately following the death of Tokugawa Yoshimune, the shogunate ordered a particularly harsh construction project upon the Shimazu clan, the longtime rulers of Satsuma Domain in southern Kyushu. You may recall that the Shimazu clan had opposed Tokugawa Ieyasu at the Battle of Sekigahara, and that they were one of the only clans who did so without any penalty, at least as regards land seizures. From Ieyasu's perspective, this was partly to avoid provoking the Shimazu into further defiance, which would require a costly campaign in Kyushu. The shogunate's ensuing relationship with the Shimazu clan was largely conciliatory, and they granted many exemptions for the Shimazu which they would have outright denied to any other clan. The Shimazu were only expected to spend every third year in Edo for Sankin Kotai rather than every other year, and they were also exempt from the shogunate's general policy that each domain should have only one castle. Thus, Satsuma Domain was dotted with castles, which could be granted to retainers and vassals. However, the Bakufu largely looked upon Satsuma Domain with grave suspicion, worrying over a potential rebellion from the far end of the nation. There does seem to have been a certain quid pro quo among the Shimazu clan, however, as they likely harbored no desire to actually go toe-to-toe with the Bakufu. The shogun's orders were always carried out with a vigorous zeal which bordered on fanaticism. When Christianity was declared illegal, the authorities in Satsuma Han eagerly rooted out hidden Christians and subjected them to brutal torture. However, they did enjoy trade with the Ryukyu Islands to the south, which also included some Chinese goods which were passed through Ryukyu and onto Satsuma itself. Although this trade was technically illegal, the shogunate normally turned a blind eye. In the winter of 1754, early in the reign of the disinterested Tokugawa Ieyasu, the Bakufu issued an official order to Satsuma Domain to improve the Nobi Plain, which was home to many large rivers and frequently suffered from massive flooding. While this may sound like a humanitarian infrastructure improvement, it was the Bakufu's intention to further deplete the resources of Satsuma Domain and force the Shimazu clan even deeper into debt. The Shimazu themselves were somewhat split on the issue, and a significant number of their samurai proposed rejecting the order and even fighting the shogunate directly. However, they were in the minority, and cooler heads soon prevailed. The Shimazu already collectively owed more than 660,000 ryo, and now they added a further 70,000 ryo to fund this large-scale project. Construction began about a month later and would eventually involve nearly 950 laborers. Leading this project was Hirata Yukie, who served the clan as a karo, which was like a vice governor of the domain. However, the agents of the Bakufu who were observing the project made it their business to interfere and cause trouble. The primary object of construction was a dike, which was meant to control water levels and prevent flooding. However, when the dike itself was nearly completed, the Bakufu observers claimed that it possessed some defect or was higher or lower than regulations allowed and ordered it to be destroyed. Three times the dike was destroyed in this way, and the Shimazu clan was forced to borrow even more money from lenders in Osaka. Eventually, their debt for this project alone ballooned from 70,000 ryo to a whopping 400,000 ryo, making their total debt over 1,000,000 ryo. Adjusted for inflation and conversion, 400,000 ryo in the 1750s is roughly equivalent to $200 million, and 1,000,000 ryo is around $500 million US today. Two of the samurai supervising the work on behalf of the Shimazu clan committed seppuku in protest when the Bakufu officials ordered the dike's destruction. Hirata Yukie kept their deaths secret from the shogunate for fear of reprisals, but those were far from the only deaths involved in this project. By that summer, over 150 workers contracted dysentery, and 33 died as a result. Further seppukus from protesting samurai supervisors were forthcoming, and eventually over 50 committed ritual suicide as a last-ditch effort to halt the project or at least wash their hands of the ruin it was bringing to their clan. Ultimately, the project was abandoned as hopeless in the spring of 1755, and the Bakufu agents returned to Edo to report the Shimazu clan's failure. Hirata Yukie committed seppuku soon after as an apology for the massive losses incurred, both financial and human. 85 perished in the course of this failed construction project, mostly by seppuku. The affair is known as the 1754 Horeki River Incident, named for the Horeki Imperial era in which it took place. In a somewhat ironic twist, flooding on the Nobi Plain grew significantly worse after the failed construction project. During the later Meiji period, which we will explore next season, the Horeki River would receive the necessary improvements to prevent flooding and manage the flow of its rivers. Today, a Shinto shrine sits near the place where the rivers were finally brought under control, dedicated to the memories of the 85 who died in 1754 and 1755.
Have you ever wondered what the band AC/DC has to do with the missing town of Doveland, Wisconsin? Or who gets to decide what music plays at the end of the world? Or whether or not the largest unsolved art heist in history was actually a cover for a different crime? Maybe you haven't wondered about these things, but that's okay. On 31, we dive into strange, true, but often lesser known stories and the interesting theories that surround them. From space to sports, lost media to internet lore, 31 has something for everyone. Find 31 on your favorite podcast platform and dive into the why behind the weird with me, Quinn Lovecraft. 31, the why behind the weird.
By the mid-1700s, many samurai nationwide settled into new professions, often undertaking an artisanal profession. Many of these were ronin, who had accepted that it was extremely unlikely for them to find employment as a samurai for one of the great clans. Some samurai even managed to use their social status as an entrepreneurial fashion by offering to adopt members of the merchant or artisan classes for a fee, which would confer samurai status upon the adoptee and their children. The kabuki plays and bunraku puppet dramas of the time often portrayed them as layabouts and hotheads, who often comedically started fights with shopkeeps or brothel operators, which they would then hilariously lose. Many samurai, however, chose to follow a more scholarly path in hopes of gaining employment with the bakufu. Neo-Confucian schools flourished during this time as samurai dreamed of becoming the next Arai Hakuseki. Political discussions and vigorous debates were part and parcel of this education, and many scholars, both samurai and lowborn, began to question the seclusionary laws which define Japan's foreign policy. While it may have been originally cast as a necessary set of measures to protect the nation against dangerous foreign influences like Christianity, which Edo-period Japanese people would have associated with the tragic Shimabara Rebellion, many began to view sakoku as an unnecessary obstacle preventing positive development through outside inspiration. The chaotic, unstable economy that became endemic throughout the reign of Tokugawa Yoshimune and his successor Ieyasu was a problem which, by the latter half of the 1700s, seemed well outside the capability of the bakufu to set right. Why not see if the foreigners had some suggestions? One of the most prominent early champions of Western scholarship in Japan was a rather brilliant man named Aoki Konyo. The son of a fishmonger in Edo, Aoki Konyo traveled to Kyoto to study Confucianism under a famous teacher. He returned to Edo and gained the patronage of Ōka Tadasuke, through whom he was given access to the Tokugawa Library. He made a name for himself by studying the sweet potato, which had been brought to Japan in the early 1700s via the Ryukyu Kingdom's trade with Satsuma Domain, but had yet to gain popularity among cultivators nationwide. After writing a treatise titled thoughts on barbarian yams, Konyo was granted samurai status and given authority over experimental fields in the Edo area, where he experimented with growing sweet potatoes. Thanks to his research and the Bakufu's promotion thereof, sweet potatoes began to proliferate among country farmers throughout the nation and often proved a valuable source of emergency food during times of famine. Aoki Konyo next turned his attention toward Western studies. Although the technical name for this field was Rangaku, which means Dutch studies, Western studies is the preferred term because much of what the Japanese were receiving were Dutch translations of works from around Europe. Konyo wrote many books about Western studies and about the Dutch language, and he frequently conversed with Dutch captains who traveled to Edo every few years for the official embassy with the shogun. The works of Aoki Konyo helped inspire a phenomenon called rampeki, which literally means Dutch craze. Scholars, physicians, and other specialists began eagerly learning Dutch and poring over the available works to discover knowledge heretofore unknown in Japan. One scholar from this period in particular stands above the rest, a charismatic and remarkable man named Hiraga Gennai. Born into a low-ranking provincial samurai family in Sanuki province on northeastern Shikoku, Hiraga Gennai apprenticed with an herbalist in 1741 when he was 12 years old. When he turned 18, he was offered a position managing the herb garden of Matsudaira Yoriyasu, the daimyo of Takamatsu domain in Sanuki. In 1752, as the Dutch craze was spreading throughout the nation, Gennai's daimyo sent him to Nagasaki to learn from the Dutch themselves. He studied Western medicine, including pre-modern surgical techniques and ceramics. Throughout the rest of his life, Hiraga Gennai lived as an eclectic Renaissance man, exploring nearly every available facet of Western learning, including oil painting, botany, mining precious metals, and many other fields of scientific study. While he undertook much of this learning as a representative of Takamatsu Han for the purpose of helping the daimyo improve the domain, he found himself driven by a desire to learn all that he could. He traveled to Edo and for a time appeared to continue his activities as a faithful retainer, but eventually he requested an indefinite leave of absence from Matsudaira Yoriyasu. They had some disagreement about the conditions of this leave, however, and Hiraga Gennai resigned and became a ronin. He penned several satirical works of literature and authored several stage plays under a pseudonym. In addition to his eclectic lifestyle as a scholar of diverse subjects, Hiraga Gennai was also homosexual. While we have previously understood homosexuality in Japanese history as something that people practiced rather than lived as a lifestyle, the Edo period witnessed a remarkable change in understanding of sexuality. Rather than practicing homosexuality on occasion, Gennai was what was known as an onnagirai, a term which literally means woman-hater, and essentially identifies men who exclusively practice homosexuality to the exclusion of any heterosexual arrangements. His aforementioned plays and fiction novels largely featured plots which would be categorized as gay romance today. In 1770, after discovering a way to cultivate ginseng in Japan, a huge accomplishment since the medicinal herb was previously imported solely from China, he returned to Nagasaki and experimented with electricity. He acquired an electrostatic generator called erekiteru in Japanese and made observations about static electricity. Being that this was the late 1700s, this was not a time in which electricity was understood with any great clarity by anyone in the world, so naturally some students of Western studies came to believe that static electricity had medicinal properties. Frankly, a large portion of the medical information which Japanese scholars were learning from the Dutch sources were almost certainly filled with things like the four humors, bleeding as a treatment, and a number of other long-since debunked ideas about the human body. Science, in its modern sense, was still a long way off. Hiraga Gennai made a living using his vast knowledge base to solve problems and develop domains around the nation. He assisted in mining engineering, improving methods of riverboat construction, and made improvements to the glazing and decoration of Japanese pottery. Ceramic pieces created by him are referred to as Gennai ware, and they feature vibrant colors, attractive finishes, and eye-catching designs. Through his efforts, Japanese pottery, which was made for export, was improved and experienced a surge in global demand. In the summer of 1779, he returned to Edo, where he undertook a project repairing and renovating a daimyo's residence. The details of the incident are scant, but it appears that Hiraga Gennai killed one of his followers, either because of a misunderstanding or while he was in a drunken rage. He was arrested and sentenced to execution, a sentence which was carried out in early 1780. In spite of his tragic end, he was still admired as a scholar with an insatiable curiosity. The Rompeki Dutch craze, which he had helped nurture, would continue long after he was gone. That Dutch craze itself raises an important question which is worth considering in our study of the later Edo period. If so many Japanese people were voraciously curious about Western learning and, by extension, the world outside Japan, why did the Bakufu persist in their policies of Sakoku, which forbade foreign visitors to enter Japan except through Nagasaki and only by official permission? I would propose that the shogunate likely had the same motivation for Sakoku as they did for punishing the tiny minority of samurai who had begun to clamor for imperial restoration. It was, as the title states, a question of influence. The benefits enjoyed by average citizens thanks to Western studies are numerous. Advances in botany meant increased crop yields and surplus food, which could help minimize the effects of occasional famine, for example. However, the Bakufu of the mid-1700s was not primarily concerned with making life easier or more pleasant for the common people of Japan. Their chief end was remaining in power in the present and preserving a status quo which would ensure their continued political dominance in the future. Thus, when Russia began to make more serious overtures about becoming a new trade partner, their offers were met with suspicion by the Bakufu, who did not trust this emerging European power, who seemed to have real footholds in the Far East. Tanuma Okitsugu, whom we discussed at length in the previous episode, tried to create a new trading post in Hokkaido exclusively for Russo-Japanese trade. However, after the ascension of Tokugawa Ienari and the subsequent dismissal of Okitsugu, the shogunate was split between Okitsugu's supporters and those who, following the Bakufu's usual reactionary tendencies, crafted their policies around rolling back every one of their enemy's policies, regardless of merit. Ultimately, Okitsugu's enemies in the shogunate triumphed, and the potential for trade with Russia was squashed. However, the Russians were far from satisfied about this sudden end to a trade deal which had been many years in the making. They responded with a certain amount of violence, raiding settlements on Sakhalin Island and in parts of Hokkaido as well in the ensuing years. Complicating matters for the shogunate, more nations continued to attempt trade outside of the Bakufu-controlled port of Nagasaki. There were only a few reasonable paths forward for the Tokugawa shogunate during the reign of Ienari. They could pursue further trade relations with Russia and other nations who expressed interest and try to learn from them, just as they had from the Dutch and the Chinese before them. The path they chose, however, was a path that entrenched the nation further into isolation, retrograde social policies, a failing economic system, and ultimately a stagnant society unable to adapt to changing circumstances. The critics of the Bakufu who promoted imperial restoration often argued that the shogunate's rule was based solely on the threat of violence. The shogunate had the opportunity to prove that they not only were capable of ruling through popular mandate, but that they were also capable of more than cruelly punishing wrongdoers and keeping control through surveillance and fear. It was an opportunity which they would not fail to miss. Next time, we will discuss the early years of Tokugawa Ienari's reign, during which the shogunate would try to reverse course on Okitsugu's policies and help the nation recover from the disastrous Great Tenmei Famine. Until then, thank you for listening. If you would like access to exclusive bonus episodes, as well as ad-free versions of the regular episodes, please consider supporting this podcast at patreon.com/ahistoryofjapan.
Thank you.